a lie. Why is it, then, that Psalm 74:12-17 describes the crossing as involving the defeat of a sea monster? But God has been my king from long ago, working salvation in the midst of the earth. You split open the sea, Yam, by your strength. You broke the heads of the sea monsters, Tanyanim. In the waters, you crushed the heads of Leviathan, Leviathan. You gave him as food to the desert-dwelling creatures. You split open spring and wadi. You dried up ever-flowing rivers. Yours is the day, yours is the night also. You established light and the sun. You defined all the boundaries of the earth, summer and winter. You formed them. Did you catch the language? God split open the sea and crushed the heads of sea monsters, Tanyanim, and Leviathan, Leviathan, giving the beasts as food for desert-dwelling creatures. God split open the spring and wadi, two terms frequently associated with desert water sources, and dried up rivers. What happened to the sea? To make things even more confusing, the psalm has a number of allusions to Genesis 1. In the original creation chapter, God also divided the waters. Virtually all of the language in Psalm 74:16-17 can be found in Genesis 1. Confusing? An ancient Israelite would have no trouble deciphering the message in Psalm 74 and recognizing that it ties the Exodus crossing to creation, and then links both events to slaying a sea monster known as Leviathan. The symbolic imagery of Leviathan and the sea, Yam, is well known from the ancient literature of Ugarit, a city-state in ancient Syria. Of the stories that have survived from Ugarit, one of the most famous describes how Baal became king of the gods. This story is the backdrop for Psalm 74. The epic tale describes how Baal battles against Yam, a deity symbolized as a chaotic, violent force, often depicted as a dragon-like sea monster. In the guise of this sea beast, Yam is also referred to by the names Tanum or Letanu. The overlap with the biblical terminology is transparent. Baal defeated the raging sea and the sea monster, earning everlasting dominion over the gods. The moral of the Ugaritic story is that the high king of the gods, Baal, has power over the unpredictable forces of nature. Genesis 1 and 2 don't provide the Bible's only creation story. Psalm 74 describes creation as well, as Yahweh's victory over the forces of primeval chaos. Yahweh brought the world into order, making it habitable for humanity, his people, as it were. The creation act, as described in Psalm 74, was theologically crucial for establishing Yahweh's superiority over all other gods. Baal was not king of the gods, as the Ugaritic story proclaimed. Yahweh was. Neither was Pharaoh, or any other Egyptian deity. By linking the Exodus event, the taming of the chaotic waters so that Yahweh's people could pass through them untouched, with the creation story, the biblical writers were telegraphing a simple, potent message. Yahweh is king of all gods. He is Lord of creation, not Pharaoh, who, in Egyptian theology, was responsible for maintaining creation order. The same God who created also maintains that creation and calls it into his service when needed. It's no wonder that Exodus 15:11 has Moses, on the other side of the waters, ask, "Who is like you among the gods, Yahweh?" No one in the ancient world, Israelite or otherwise, would have missed the theological punch. These passages left no question as to who was king of the unseen realm, and whose side that king was on. As creator, Yahweh had made the world habitable for all humanity, but the nations had been forsaken. Now the same God once again was described as subduing the forces of chaos to deliver his portion, Israel, for whom he had prepared a place of habitation, the promised land. But before getting to the land, Yahweh needed to teach his people a few things. It's time for some theology lessons at a place called Mount Sinai, Yahweh's new earthly abode, headquarters of his unseen council.
Chapter 20. Retooling the Template. The Exodus event, the deliverance from bondage in Egypt, was the catalyst for Israel's transition from a people to a nation. Any good commentary or guide to the Bible will flag that. But there's a good deal more going on. Over the next three chapters, we'll see that events shortly after the Exodus hark back to Eden and the Divine Council backdrop in some amazing ways. God's Edenic vision began with his announcement that humankind was his image. Yahweh had divine sons. He would also have a human family. Genesis told us that God had a divine council of imagers who represented his authority in the unseen realm and participated in his rule. It also showed us that God planned a mirror council on earth, this time composed of human imagers. These two family administrations were together in his presence. Heaven had come to earth at Eden. Humanity was charged with extending the earthly presence and rule of God throughout the whole earth. God wanted to live and rule with all his children in his new creation. Genesis 3-11 makes it clear that humanity failed miserably. Free will in the hands of imperfect beings comes with that risk. But the incident at Babel, foolish and self-willed as it was, shows us that there's an Edenic yearning in the human heart, a desire for utopia, and a sense of divine presence. But God would not trade his own version of Eden for humanity's. He punished the nations with disinheritance. He would create a new people as his own portion. That inheritance was begun in covenant with Abraham and passed on through his family. God delivered that family from bondage under Moses. Egypt and its gods were defeated. What was corrupted in Eden and counterfeited in the days of the flood and Babel was quickened to life on the other side of the waters of chaos.
Israel is my son.
Yahweh's perception of Israel is clear. Israel is my son, my firstborn. Exodus 4:22. Out of Egypt I called my son. Hosea 11:1. As Abraham, Yahweh's portion, had been the new Adam, so Israel, the collective progeny of Abraham, was also the new Adam. Adam was Yahweh's son. Israel was Yahweh's son. That may not seem profound, but it is. Once you realize that this pattern continues through the remainder of the Bible, the messaging becomes clear. Eventually God will refer to the king of Israel as his son. The ultimate future king, the Messiah, since he will sit on the seat of David, must be Yahweh's son as well. And since we, glorified believers, will sit on that throne too, sharing that rule, we are God's sons, his children. Every believer is also Abraham's offspring by faith. We are the current and eschatological sons of God. Our status began with Adam, was rescued in Abraham, and was fulfilled in Jesus, heir to David's throne. These connections are actually among the more obvious.
There is more that extends from Israel's sonship all the way to our glory.
Believing Israel, God's earthly counsel. Recall that in our discussion of Deuteronomy 32:8-9, I mentioned that the number of nations disinherited by Yahweh at the judgment of Babel was 70. The number is telling. Israel's nearest religious competition, the worship of El, Baal, and Asherah at Ugarit and in Canaan, held that their divine council had 70 sons. When Yahweh disinherited the nations and allotted them to the sons of God, a theological gauntlet was thrown down. Yahweh alone commands the nations and their gods. Other gods serve him. The Exodus story follows that theological punch in the nose with another. Not only is Israel Yahweh's son and portion on earth, but Israel is to be governed by a special group of 70 under Moses and, later, the Israelite king who is Yahweh's enthroned son. Shortly after crossing through the sea, Moses and Israel encountered Jethro. The account is recorded in Exodus 18. Seeing the throngs, Jethro advises Moses to select men to help him govern the people. No number is given in that passage. But later, in Exodus 24, we read, And to Moses he, Yahweh, said, Go up to Yahweh, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 from the elders of Israel, and you will worship at a distance.
And Moses alone will come near to Yahweh, and they will not come near, and the people will not go up with him.
And Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 from the elders of Israel went up. And they saw the God of Israel, and what was under his feet was like sapphire tile work, and like the very heavens for clearness. Exodus 24:1-2 and 9-10. The wording suggests that these 70 elders were drawn from a larger group,
as were the Elohim of Yahweh's council, who were given different ranks and tasks.
Not every member of the divine council has equal rank. The sons of God with authority over the nations were assigned that role, but they became corrupt and are the object of the sentencing of Psalm 82. The correspondences are deliberate. The 70 nations were placed under the dominion of lesser gods in the wake of Yahweh's judgment of the nations at the Tower of Babel. Yahweh's own kingdom is structured with a single leader, Moses for now, with whom he speaks directly, and a council of 70. Historically, this leadership structure would continue into Jesus' day as the Jewish Sanhedrin, led by the high priest, numbered 70. We're more interested in the theological messaging. In terms of biblical theology, the imagery has a distinct meaning. God is starting his intended Edenic rule with Israel. Israel will have a single earthly leader, eventually the Messianic king, the ultimate offspring of Eve, and a council of 70. The number telegraphs that, as the kingdom of God is reestablished on earth, the 70 nations will be reclaimed, a process that began with the ministry of Jesus and will continue to the end of days. The ultimate outcome of the reclaiming of the nations under Yahweh is suggested in passages that transparently relate to the divine council. Loyal members of Yahweh's council are themselves referred to as his elders in Isaiah 24:23, the context of which is clearly eschatological. On that day, the Lord will punish the host of heaven, in heaven, and the kings of the earth, on the earth. Then the moon will be confounded, and the sun ashamed, for the Lord of hosts reigns on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and his glory will be before his elders. Isaiah 24:21 and 23.
That setting makes sense, giving the divine council scene of Revelation 4-5, where the 24 elders surround God's throne. The teaching point is profound. The corrupt sons of God who currently dominate the nations will be replaced by loyal members of God's family. But which family? The New Testament explains that.
Heirs of the cosmos. Since the church, the corporate body of believers, inherited the promises given to Abraham, believers are the true Israel the New Testament talks about. When we inherit rule of the nations with Jesus at the end of days, we will displace the corrupted divine sons of God presently ruling the nations who are under judgment. We are already, but not yet, Yahweh's new council on earth. The Apostle John captures the spirit of the point. But as many as received him, to those who believe in his name, he gave them authority to become children of God. John 1:12. See what sort of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God. And we are. 1 John 3:1. This structuring helps us make sense of something else Paul said. The rulership of the nations was a higher ranking task than being a messenger, the meaning of the word angel. The destiny of believers who will share Jesus' throne and the rule of nations is the backdrop for Paul's statement that Christians should stop letting the world's courts resolve their disputes. In 1 Corinthians 6:3, he protests, Do you not know that we will judge angels? When we are made divine, glorified, on the new earth, we will outrank angels. Believers are God's once and future family, once and future council, once and future rulers with Jesus over all the nations. Israel's release propels this theology. The glorified, divine aspect of Yahweh's human family council is telegraphed in other ways. The divine sons of God are called the morning stars in Job 38:7 and the stars of God in Isaiah 14:13. The imagery of Joseph's dream where the sons of Jacob, Israel, are stars is no accident. Neither is it a coincidence that Abraham's offspring will be as the stars.
While that phrase speaks of a numerical multitude of offspring, that isn't its only message.
Star language speaks of divinity or glorification elsewhere. In Revelation, Jesus himself, the morning star, and angels are identified with star language to denote their divine, non-earthly nature. As Daniel says, the righteous will shine like the brightness of the sky above, like the stars, forever and ever. Daniel 12, 2-3. Our inheritance of the nations with Jesus at the end of days is in a glorified, resurrected, divine state. The star language of Genesis 15 has an eschatological connotation. In Romans, Paul was tracking on this idea. Scholars have noticed, with interest, his slight change of the language of Genesis 15, God's promises to Abraham in Romans 4. Note: this interpretive trajectory is part of New Testament and Second Temple period Jewish thinking on the glorification, also called angelification, apotheosis, and deification, of believers. Second Temple period examples of this approach include Philo of Alexandria. The eschatological ramifications of that thinking are the coherent outcome of the Deuteronomy 32 worldview's final resolution in biblical theology. Burnett's essay is particularly powerful in that it demonstrates a clear Jewish intellectual trajectory, especially Philo, that links the glorification of Abraham's seed, all believers, via Galatians 3:26-29, to the divine sons of God. Glorified believers are Yahweh's household council, reconstituted to displace and replace the rebellious sons of God over the nations who now resist the advance of Yahweh's kingdom and reclamation of the nations. See the companion website for more discussion. End note. In Genesis 15:5, the embodied Yahweh brought Abraham outside and said, "Look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them." And he said to him, "So shall your offspring be."
Paul refers to the verse twice in Romans 4.
"So that Abraham became the father of many nations, according to what was said, 'So will your descendants be.'" Romans 4:18. "For the promise to Abraham or to his descendants, that he would be heir of the world," Greek, cosmos, "was not through the law, but through the righteousness by faith." Romans 4:13. A few observations are in order. For Paul, Abraham did not become the father of just Israel, but of many nations. The point, of course, harks back to his theology in Galatians 3, where all believers, Jew or Gentile, are Abraham's seed. The notion of Abraham's offspring becoming heir of the world speaks to rulership of the nations by those offspring. The corrupt, divine sons of God of Deuteronomy 32:8 would be displaced by new divine sons of God, glorified believers. Paul's logic makes sense if believers are Yahweh's children, especially given the merging of humanity with the divine presence back in Eden. Even now, we are sharers of the divine nature, 2 Peter 1:4. But one day we will be made like Jesus and rule with him over the nations. Believers, the spiritual offspring of Abraham, will ultimately reverse the disinheritance of the nations along with the curse of death that extended from Eden's failure. Eden and Sinai. In Genesis, Eden was Yahweh's home and the meeting place of his divine council. God had since changed addresses. Sinai was now his domain, and where Israel was now headed. Earlier we discovered that Eden was the dwelling place and headquarters of the divine council. We were reminded of the description of Eden in Genesis as a lush garden with four rivers. Eden was also a mountain, the administrative seat of the gods, situated in the heart of the seas, a description that reiterated the well-watered imagery of the council headquarters. The gods lived in the best or the most remote places. That earlier discussion noted some connections between Eden and Mount Zion. It's time to take a look at connections with Sinai. The fact that Eden is referred to as both a garden and a mountain in Ezekiel 28:13-14 is significant. It provides a clear conceptual link between Eden and the holy mountain of God, Sinai. We've actually already gotten a hint that Sinai is God's home and meeting place. In the passage about the 70 elders, Yahweh appeared in human form as he had to the patriarchs and Moses. But this time the 70 earthly elders are along for the meeting. The council room has been reserved for the 70 from Israel. Sinai, as Yahweh's throne room, is telegraphed in other ways. Exodus 24 notes that Yahweh was seated and that under his feet was a pavement of shining sapphire stone, like the very heavens for clearness. Again, light speaks of divine presence. This imagery is repeated in other passages and expanded to include fire, smoke, flashing light, lightning, and loud noises. All of these elements are found in familiar visions of Yahweh on his throne. These passages employ the same imagery whether Yahweh is enthroned in the spiritual realm or on earth. Heaven and earth are connected. Yahweh rules both. Some of these passages have the divine council, the heavenly host, present. That is to be expected in view of other Eden-Sinai connections. For example, in the throne room scene of Daniel 7, we read, "As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened." Verses 9 and 10. This is one of the more explicit divine council texts in the Old Testament. There are multiple thrones in this heavenly scene, along with the single throne occupied by the Ancient of Days, the God of Israel. Note: some Jewish interpreters say the plural thrones refers to only two thrones, that of the God of Israel and the other for King David, whom they identify with the Son of Man in this passage. There are several problems with that view, namely, the passage's clear literary parallels to divine council scenes from the Ugaritic Baal cycle, and the fact that the Son of Man neither takes a seat nor has one offered to him when he approaches the Ancient of Days. See the discussion in chapter 29. It also cannot be argued that the plural seats are for human Jewish elders, since the court council in Daniel 7 is clearly in heaven and is making a decision for the human holy people at the time when the kingdom of the Son of Man is established. See Daniel 7:22. End note. There is a clear reference to the council. The word translated court here refers to a judicial body. There's another fascinating Sinai passage that links the divine council to the mountain, and also the thing that the mountain is perhaps best known for, the giving of the law. That might sound odd. In my experience, most people have Charlton Heston in their mind's eye when you bring up Sinai and the law, and there aren't any angels in that scene. But if the divine council isn't associated with the law, how do we handle verses like these? "Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who announced beforehand the coming of the righteous one, whom you have now betrayed and murdered. You who received the law as delivered by angels and did not keep it." Acts 7:52-53. "Therefore we must pay closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For since the message declared by angels proved to be reliable, and every transgression or disobedience received a just retribution, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation?" Hebrews 2:1-3a. The law delivered by angels?
Hollywood wasn't exactly following the biblical script very closely. We'll set the record straight in the next chapter.
Chapter 21. God's Law, God's Counsel.
I'll admit, it's a little hard to get excited about the law of God. How many of us would echo Paul's sentiment when he delighted in the law of God in his heart, Romans 7:22? We certainly don't think of the law like David did. The law of Yahweh is perfect, reviving life. The testimony of Yahweh is firm, making wise the simple. The precepts of Yahweh are right, making the heart rejoice. The command of Yahweh is pure, enlightening the eyes. Psalm 19:7-8. We tend to think of the law as though every one of its 663 commands were an oppressive linchpin in a relationship to Yahweh. We tend to view the law negatively, as though it were given to produce feelings of guilt or to frustrate Israelites with the impossibility of pleasing God. This is misguided. The laws of the Torah broadly deal with a person's relationship to Yahweh, for example, worship, access to sacred space, relationships with fellow Israelites or outsiders, for example, sex, business, property, and the nation's covenantal bond with her God. The law was not a means of meriting salvation. An Israelite would have known that believing was at the heart of right relationship with Yahweh, not mere mechanical observance of a list of do's and don'ts. For sure, some Israelites would have lapsed into this mistaken thinking, particularly after the shock of the exile, but that wasn't what the law was about. Note: the Torah was clear that possession of the promised land was linked to obedience, particularly in regard to rejecting the worship of other gods and idolatry. The preaching of the prophets, the destruction of the temple, and expulsion from the land itself jolted the exiled Israelites to the realization that their exile was due to disobedience. Consequently, the Torah became the central focus of the surviving community. In exile, the teaching of the law in the new institution of the synagogue replaced temple ritual in the religious life of the community. Synagogues and the focus on the law were retained even after the return to the land and the building of a new temple. With Israel determined to never be driven from the land again, the law became the orientation point for Judaism. The focus on obedience to the law became a way for the Jewish community to express commitment to God's election of Israel and remain in the land. With respect to this mentality, one scholar, F. Thielman, notes, "To the exiles, the Pentateuch's curses for disobedience to the covenant must have appeared to be a breathtakingly accurate prediction of the Babylonian invasion and subsequent exile. Thus, when the Persians overran the Babylonians and subsequently allowed expatriate Israelites to return to their native land, the leaders of the return understandably resolved to adhere strictly to the law and so to avoid future punishments for disobedience. Their Achilles' heel, prior to the exile, they believed, was their seduction into idolatry by foreign influences. The road to a restored covenant relationship with God, they reasoned, was a renewed determination to fence themselves off from harmful foreign influences by strictly obeying the law." End note. In other words, legalism was not intrinsic to a biblical theology of the law. The heart of salvation in biblical theology across both testaments is believing loyalty to Yahweh. That orientation extends from Eden and has deep roots in what happened at Sinai. It is no coincidence that when Israel, Yahweh's portion, met with him at Sinai, the result was a second covenant involving laws binding Israel and Yahweh in faithfulness, witnessed by the members of Yahweh's divine council. The Cosmic Mountain, Birthplace of the Law. In the last chapter, we were introduced to the connections between Eden and Sinai. Both were sacred places where Yahweh's children saw him in human form. We ended our discussion with the provocative notion that the divine council was present at God's mountain, specifically during the giving of the law. The link between the law and the heavenly council is noted several times in the New Testament, which uses, for the divine council, the umbrella term, angels. I close the last chapter with two passages that describe the law as delivered by angels, Acts 7:53, and declared by angels, Hebrews 2:2. Note. Recall that the New Testament language for divine beings is less hierarchically precise than the Old Testament. As we'll see in chapter 37, while Paul uses terms for divine beings that reflect geographical authority, for example, principalities and powers, most New Testament vocabulary is simplified. Good divine beings are predominantly referred to with angelos, angel, whereas the terms of choice for evil ones are daimon and daimonion. All three of these terms are actually neutral, neither good nor evil, in wider Greek usage. They refer to, respectively, messengers and spirit beings. The idea of a divine messenger presumes a being sent by God for good purposes, and so angelos became the common term for benevolent spirits. This is not to suggest, however, that Jewish theology in the Hellenistic era was trying to rid itself of terms like Hebrew, plural, Elohim, or Elim, gods, or Greek theoi. Jewish texts in both Hebrew and Greek before and during the first century utilize this vocabulary as well. End note. When I first came across these New Testament verses, I had read a lot of the Old Testament and had never before seen this idea, so I naturally wondered where the New Testament writers were getting it. It's actually a prickly problem. There are passages that describe angels at Sinai, but none of them specifically reference the law. For example, Psalm 68, 15-18 reads, "A mountain of God is the mountain of Bashan. A mountain of many peaks is the mountain of Bashan. Why do you look with hostility, O many-peaked mountains? This mountain God desires for his dwelling. Yes, Yahweh will abide in it forever. The chariots of God are twice 10,000, with thousands doubled. The Lord is among them at Sinai, distinctive in victory. You have ascended on high. You have led away captives. You have received gifts from among humankind, and even from the rebellious, so that Yah God may dwell there." Without direct reference to the law, the New Testament idea in Acts 7 and Hebrews 2 seems completely contrived, unless you're using as your Old Testament the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament that was the Bible of the early church. A second Sinai passage that is a key text for connecting the law and the heavenly host is Deuteronomy 33:1-4. The Septuagint version has a multitude of divine beings at Sinai, whereas the traditional Hebrew text does not. That isn't the only divergence either. Take a look at the passage in both versions, especially the emphasized words. A chart comparing the traditional Masoretic Hebrew text with the Septuagint. Traditional Masoretic Hebrew Text. "Now this is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, blessed the Israelites before his death. Then he said, Yahweh came from Sinai, and he dawned upon them from Seir. He shone forth from Mount Paran, and he came with myriads of holy ones, at his right hand a fiery law for them. Moreover, he loves his people. All the holy ones were in your hand, and they bowed down at your feet. Each one accepted directions from you, a law Moses instructed for us as a possession for the assembly of Jacob." The Septuagint reading. "And this is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, blessed the Israelites before his death. He said, The Lord has come from Sinai, and he appeared to us from Seir. He made haste from Mount Paran with 10,000s of Kadesh at his right, his angels with him. And he had pity on his people, and all the holy ones were under your hands, even these were under you. And it, the people, received his words, the law which Moses commanded us, an inheritance for the assemblies of Jacob." End chart. The fundamental difference is that the Septuagint version has angels at Sinai, and the traditional text doesn't. In verse 3, the traditional Hebrew text seems to suggest that the holy ones are the Israelites who will receive the law, The Septuagint has angels at God's right hand, the position of authority, witnessing the giving of the law to Israel. Since the New Testament writers most often use the Septuagint when referencing the Old Testament, we can understand the point being made in Acts 7:52-53 and Hebrews 2:1-2. However, Galatians 3:19 adds a tantalizing detail that makes the connection more dramatic. Why then the law? It was added because of transgressions, until the offspring should come to whom the promise had been made, and it was put in place through angels by an intermediary. Galatians 3:19 informs us that there was an intermediary between God, the angels, and Israel. Most scholars assume this is a reference to Moses. Other scholars have noted that, in light of the very next verse, this is problematic. Now an intermediary implies more than one, but God is one. Why would Paul feel the need to clarify that God's uniqueness wasn't disturbed by this intermediary if it was just Moses? There's another solution, one that explains Paul's ensuing comment. The intermediary is Yahweh in human form. Deuteronomy 33 uses language requiring the appearance of Yahweh in human form. Appeared. His right. In this light, Deuteronomy 9:9-10 takes on new significance. Moses says, "When I went up the mountain to receive the stone tablets, the tablets of the covenant that Yahweh made with you, and remained on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights, I did not eat food and I did not drink water. And Yahweh gave me the two tablets of stone written with the finger of God, and on them was writing according to all the words that Yahweh spoke with you at the mountain from the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly." This language is, by now, very familiar, the language of human physicality, finger applied to Yahweh. This is the stock description of the second Yahweh, the angel. It shouldn't be a surprise that the New Testament speaks of angelic mediation for the law. It was written by the angel who is God in the presence of council members, the holy ones, and then dispensed to Israel through Moses. The Sinai Law Covenant and its Witnesses. The core idea of the law being delivered and declared by angels is depicted in Deuteronomy 33:1-4. The divine beings of Yahweh's council witness the agreement. Note: the idea put forth in this chapter is that the language of those passages in both testaments that involve divine beings of the council with the law is not that God's law had to be approved by angels, signed off, or that select angels took the tablets, as it were, to the Israelites. Rather, it is that the divine council served as witnesses to the dispensing of the law, not in terms of them merely seeing the event, but as official participants in the context of the way covenants were enacted. This view not only is consistent with ancient Near Eastern treaty concepts, but accounts for the various ways the idea is expressed in New Testament verses. End note. This information is provided somewhat cryptically, at least to our eyes. We need to read closely and, to some degree, in Hebrew to catch the clues. Scholars agree that the events of Sinai after the Exodus established a covenant between Yahweh and his people Israel. Covenants were basically agreements or enactments of a relationship. Yahweh's deliverance of the Israelites from Egypt was prompted by the earlier covenant promises he had made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The events leading up to the miraculous deliverance from Egypt alluded to the earlier promises. Abraham's offspring had become a multitude in Egypt, and, as God had told Abraham centuries earlier, had become strangers in a foreign land. God had rescued them, and now, at Sinai, was setting the terms of the relationship. The covenant between Yahweh and Israel, enacted at Sinai, follows the conventions of a type of covenant known from ancient Near Eastern sources. Scholars refer to it as a vassal treaty. This type of covenant was, in essence, an oath of loyalty by an inferior, the vassal, here Israel, to a superior, Yahweh, the initiator of the agreement. The basic stipulations of the covenant relationship were what we know as the Ten Commandments. though there are other laws in Exodus 20-23. As with the earlier Abrahamic covenant, a sacrificial ritual was performed to ratify the covenant. After the ritual, there was a sacrificial meal between the parties involved. This was the divine council scene in Exodus 24:9-11 that we've already briefly noted. A former vassal treaty in the ancient Near East regularly listed third-party witnesses to its enactment. As one scholar notes, the witnesses were exclusively deities or deified elements of the natural world. All gods relevant to both parties were called upon as witnesses, so that there was no god left that the vassal could appeal to for protection if he wanted to violate his solemn oath. The gods were covenant enforcers in this worldview. Israelites, of course, would not have recognized foreign gods in such a treaty. Consequently, most scholars consider this element absent in the Sinai Treaty account. But the Elohim of Yahweh's council were not foreign gods. They were Yahweh's host and witness to the giving of the law, at least according to the Hebrew text behind the Septuagint and the New Testament writers. They were also, as the account of Ahab in 1 Kings 22 indicates, Yahweh's means of punishing covenant apostates. It is at precisely this point that many scholars have failed to notice some relevant wordplay in the biblical text that also suggests this connection. The tablets of the law are referred to frequently in Exodus by the term edut. It is usually translated testimony in English Bibles. The term is used in parallel with Torah, law, in Psalms 19:7 and 78:5, so at the very least it speaks of the written text of the law. Exodus 25:16 informs us that Yahweh commanded Moses to place the edut in the Ark of the Covenant. In fact, the Ark was made for the edut. This explains why the Ark is also called the Ark of the Edut. Since the Ark traveled inside the tabernacle, that mobile tent structure was also called the Tabernacle of the Edut, or the Tent of the Edut. What makes this interesting is that the term edut can also mean witnesses. In fact, this plural's equivalent in Akkadian, the language of the vassal treaties that serve as the model for the Sinai Treaty in Exodus, is a technical term used exclusively of witnesses to such a treaty. This is not to suggest that the term doesn't refer to the laws on the tablets. Rather, since the tablets themselves occupy sacred space reserved only for Yahweh's presence, inside the Ark, within the Holy of Holies, the term appears to signify that the tablets of the law were also a sort of proxy for the divine council members who witnessed the event. In other words, the tablets of law were tokens of the event at Sinai itself. They were stone reminders of a divine encounter with Yahweh and his council in much the same way that altars and standing stones built by the patriarchs would have reminded passers-by that they marked a divine encounter. Again, Yahweh's presence in his home, Eden, Sinai, Tabernacle, and eventually the temple, implies by definition his throne room along with his attending council. The tablets not only contained the covenant terms, but were a reminder of the event as it occurred with the divine council present on Sinai. The Law and Salvation. In simplest terms, the Sinai covenant conveyed Yahweh's will for what he intended Israel to be, in relation both to him and to the disinherited nations. Israel was to be theologically and ethically distinct. These distinctions were obligations, not suggestions. Israel was to be holy and fulfill God's original Edenic purpose of spreading his influence, his kingdom rule, throughout all the nations. Israel's status as Yahweh's own portion was not an end in itself, but the means by which Israel would draw all nations back to Yahweh. This is the idea behind Israel being a kingdom of priests and a light to the nations. It's no wonder that the book of Revelation uses the same language of believers in Revelation 5:10, a divine council scene in connection with ruling over all the earth. The entire nation inherited the status and duty of Abraham that, through him, and now them, all nations would be blessed. But did this salvation come by obeying rules? To ask the question is to miss the point. Salvation in the Old Testament means love for Yahweh alone. One had to believe that Yahweh was the God of all gods, trusting that this Most High God had chosen covenant relationship with Israel to the detriment of all other nations. The law was how one demonstrated that love, that loyalty. Salvation was not merited. Yahweh alone had initiated the relationship. Yahweh's choice and covenant promise had to be believed. An Israelite's believing loyalty was shown by faithfulness to the law. The core of the law was fidelity to Yahweh alone, above all gods. To worship other gods was to demonstrate the absence of belief, love, and loyalty. Doing the works of the law without having the heart aligned only to Yahweh was inadequate. This is why the promise of the possession of the promised land is repeatedly and inextricably linked in the Torah to the first two commandments, that is, staying clear of idolatry and apostasy. The history of Israel's kings illustrates the point. King David was guilty of the worst of crimes against humanity in the incident with Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite. He was clearly in violation of the law and deserving of death. Nevertheless, his belief in who Yahweh was among all gods never wavered. God was merciful to him, sparing him from death, though his sin had consequences the rest of his life. But there was no doubt that David was ever a believer in Yahweh and never worshipped another. Yet other kings of Israel and Judah were tossed aside and both kingdoms sent into exile because they worshipped other gods. Personal failure, even of the worst kind, did not send the nation into exile. Choosing other gods did. The same is true in the New Testament. Believing the gospel means believing that Yahweh, the God of Israel, came to earth incarnated as a man, voluntarily died on the cross as a sacrifice for our sin, and rose again on the third day. That is the content of our faith, this side of the cross. Our believing loyalty is demonstrated by our obedience to the law of Christ. We cannot worship another. Salvation means believing loyalty to Christ, who was and is the visible Yahweh. There is no salvation in any other name, and faith must remain intact. Personal failure is not the same as trading Jesus for another god, and God knows that. Believing loyalty was therefore not just academic. By definition, it must be conscious and active. Israel knew that her God had fought for her and loved her, but the relationship came with expectations. As she embarked for the promised land, Israel would have daily visible reminders not only of Yahweh's presence, but of his total otherness. Having the divine presence with you could be both fantastic and frightening. Chapter 22. Realm Distinction. We've been tracking the story of Yahweh and his portion, Abraham's descendants. Yahweh chose to disinherit the nations at Babel. He chose to appear to Abraham in visible human form to initiate a covenant relationship. He chose to reiterate that covenant with Isaac and Jacob, whom he renamed Israel. And he chose to deliver Israel from Egypt. These choices telegraphed theological messages. Israel existed because Yahweh had supernaturally enabled the birth of Isaac. They continued to exist because Yahweh wanted a people on earth by his own plan and by his own power. The lesser Elohim he had placed over the disinherited nations, particularly those in Egypt at this point of the story, cannot prevent his will. There is no God like Yahweh. His goal of making the earth a new Eden will not be overturned. Before the plagues and the exodus from Egypt, the descendants of Jacob knew Yahweh only by reputation and oral storytelling. Now they were at his mountain, ready to journey to the land he had taken for himself and for them. They had the tablets of the law, but that was just a starting point. Egypt and her gods had been defeated, but the conflict with the gods and their nations was just beginning. Israel needed to understand that being Yahweh's portion meant separation from the gods and the nations who stood ready to oppose them. The concept of realm distinction was fundamental to the supernatural worldview of ancient Israel. Holiness and sacred space. Yahweh is an Elohim, not a mortal man. Appearing as a human being was a condescension that enabled the lesser minds of mortals to comprehend his presence and live to tell about it. Yahweh is so other as to be incomprehensible without the facade of something familiar. And yet, for Israel, his otherness would need to remain an ever-present reality, sensed at all times. The concept of otherness was at the core of Israelite identity. Otherness is the core of holiness. The Hebrew vocabulary for holiness means to be set apart or to be distinct. While the idea has a moral dimension related to conduct, it is not intrinsically about morality. It is about distinction. Israel's identification with Yahweh by virtue of his covenant with Abraham and the terms of the covenant at Sinai meant that, as Leviticus 19:2 concisely summarizes, Israelites were to be set apart, holy, as Yahweh was set apart, holy. Yahweh's complete otherness was reinforced in the minds of Israelites through worship and sacrifice. Yahweh was not only the source of Israel's life, he was life. Yahweh was complete in his perfections. Yahweh was not of earth, a place where there is death, disease, and imperfection. His realm is supernatural, ours is terrestrial. The space he occupies is sacred and made otherworldly by his presence. The space we occupy is profane or ordinary. Yahweh is the antithesis of ordinary. Humans must be invited and purified to occupy the same space. Many laws in the Torah illustrate this worldview and its messaging. Whether priest or not, male or female, people could be disqualified from sacred space by a variety of activities and conditions. Examples include sexual activity, bodily emissions, physical handicaps, contact with a dead body, and childbirth. The logic of such exclusions is simple, yet foreign to our modern clinical minds. Sexual intercourse, emission of sexual fluids, uterine discharge, and menstruation were not considered unclean out of prudishness. Rather, the concept was that the body had lost the fluids that contain, create, and sustain life. That which is not whole and is associated with loss of life cannot enter Yahweh's presence until ritual restoration rectified that status. The same reasoning is behind the ritually unclean status of those with physical handicaps, infected with disease, and who have touched a corpse, animal or human. Yahweh's presence meant life and perfection, not death and defectiveness. These laws kept the community conscious of Yahweh's otherness. Regulations governing the sanctity of Yahweh's dwelling provided concrete object lessons about realm distinction. The ground that that dwelling encompassed was sacred space in relationship to the people of Israel. The separateness of the divine realm was reinforced by the laws that allowed or disallowed proximity to Yahweh. These permissions or prohibitions even extended to inanimate objects associated with Yahweh and his service. Even within sacred space, there were gradations of holiness or sanctity. The closer one got to Yahweh's presence, the more holy the ground or the object in his proximity. The terms that describe the layout of the structure are evidence of this progression. From the entrance inward, there was the court, the holy place, and the most holy place, Holy of Holies. The sacred space of the tabernacle got progressively more holy from the entrance to the innermost room. The progressive holiness zones were also distinguished by the priestly clothing associated with them. For example, the high priest, the person with permitted access to the holiest place, wore a unique ephod, breastplate, and headdress inscribed with Holy to Yahweh. The holier the zone, the more costly the animal sacrificed to sanctify the priests when they entered into the presence of Yahweh for rituals. The Tabernacle, Heaven on Earth. That Yahweh dwelled in a tent before the construction of the temple, much later during the time of Solomon, is important for marking sacred space. The tabernacle, Hebrew Mishkan, dwelling, was the place where Yahweh would cause his name, his presence, to dwell. Note. See chapter 18 for the name theology of the Old Testament. The whole subject of the tabernacle is not without problems. Before the tabernacle was constructed, Moses would meet with Yahweh in a small tent called the Tent of Meeting. Though some scholars take the Tent of Meeting and the tabernacle as the same structure, Exodus 33:7-11 has the Tent of Meeting in existence prior to the tabernacle. The issue is actually complicated, as the phrase Tent of Meeting is at times clearly used with respect to the tabernacle, and at other times, clearly not. Passages such as Exodus 33:7-11 provide several indications that the Tent of Meeting was distinct from the tabernacle. 1. The passage itself appears in Exodus before the construction of the tabernacle. 2. One man, Moses, could construct the tent, unlike the much larger tabernacle which took scores of workers to tear down, erect, and transport. 3. The Tent of Meeting was outside the camp, unlike the tabernacle which was in the middle of the camp. 4. The Tent of Meeting was guarded and maintained by a single person. 5. There is no indication that the Tent of Meeting was a place of sacrifice, or that the Ark of the Covenant was kept in it. The solution is apparently that, prior to the tabernacle, there was a Tent of Meeting where Yahweh lived and would meet Moses. Either the tent structure was moved inside the tabernacle as the Holy of Holies, or, more coherently, the tented Holy of Holies became a new Tent of Meeting after the tabernacle's construction. However, certain passages in the historical books inform us that there was a Tent of Meeting after the tabernacle was in existence. Whether these passages describe a still extant original Tent of Meeting, or a tent structure that housed holy objects during the chaos of the period of the Judges and the separation of the Ark of the Covenant from the tabernacle, is a matter of debate. End note. As the divine abode, the tabernacle was also analogous to Eden. Like Eden, the tabernacle was cosmic in conception, the place where heaven and earth met, a veritable microcosm of the Edenic creation where God first dwelt on earth. There are many subtle connections between Eden and the tabernacle, some of them discernible only in the Hebrew text. For our purposes, several of the more obvious are worth noting. To begin, the description of the tabernacle as a tent dwelling is significant. Elsewhere in the biblical world, deities and their councils were considered to live in tents, atop their cosmic mountains and in their lush gardens. The tent of the god or gods was, as with mountains or lush gardens, the place where heaven and earth intersected and where divine decrees were issued. This was a common cultural idea, perhaps akin to how many people think of church. Church is a place you'd expect to meet God, or where God can be found. Moses was told to construct the tabernacle and its equipment according to the pattern shown to him by Yahweh on the holy mountain. The implication is that the tabernacle on earth was to be a copy of the heavenly tent in accord with the religious principle of, as in heaven, so on earth. The heavenly tent prototype was the heavens themselves, as Isaiah 40:22 tells us. It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in. This kind of language is also why the earth is referred to as God's footstool. Yahweh sits above the circle of the earth in his heavenly tent, on his throne, above the waters which are above the firmament, and rests his feet on the earth, which is his footstool. As Eden was the place where humanity experienced the presence of God, so too was the tabernacle. This was particularly true for the priests, but God's presence occasionally met Israel's leaders outside the Holy of Holies, the most obvious instance being the glory cloud. The menorah, lampstand, in the tabernacle is a striking analogy with the tree of life in Eden. The lampstand was fashioned in the appearance of a tree and was stationed directly outside the Holy of Holies. The cherubim inside the Holy of Holies are also a clear connection to Eden. The Edenic cherubim stood guard at the dwelling place of God in Eden. Their position atop the lid to the Ark of the Covenant is not coincidental. The innermost sanctum of